Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water to break down a truly mad night of Champions League action is Mr. Dean Jones, live from San Diego. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I've got an easier job on these days than you do, because I just watch a game in the morning, a game at lunchtime, and that's me. But you're there, 10 o'clock at night, watching 8 games, and there's a goal every minute. So, I've definitely got the easy gig here, mate. So, more importantly, how are you? And is your laptop still working with all the steam coming off your keyboard?
Yeah, I've made a lot of notes, is basically what I'd say. I had sort of 3 laptops going. I had the Arsenal radio commentary on my phone. There was all sorts of things happening at the same time, but I feel like I've got across these games, and it's been incredible. 43 goals across 9 games today in the Champions League. That is 4.77 on average per game. Pure lunacy. And 6 teams scored 4 or more goals. Only 6 teams scored 1 or less. And 2 of those were in a 0-0 draw, which we'll ultimately do right at the end of this podcast.
Not only was it the game with the least kind of draw
from a name perspective in Kaira Almaty against Paphos, but it also turned out to be the only game without a goal. So plenty to get through, I think, is the truth of the matter. But you're going to start us off at the Emirates, where Arsenal won 4-0 against Atletico Madrid. And I suppose the question to you, and for anyone who hasn't caught this, was this as easy as it looked?
No, definitely not. Arsenal 4-0 winners. But it wasn't that sort of game, really. It doesn't reflect what the game was over 90 minutes. It was interesting, though. Arsenal have definitely grown up this season. That's what I feel like watching a game like this. It was a really good contest, and the teams were kind of feeling each other out across the first half. There were opportunities for both. And I always felt that Arsenal had a slight control, but it was just unclear exactly how they were going to get the edge. How are they going to find that breakthrough? As the game wore on, you're genuinely thinking it's just one of those games where Atleti managed to do what Atleti do. But of course, this is set-piece FC. And so, of course, we should have all predicted that the way that they find the breakthrough is through a tried and tested combination. They get a free kick, Declan Rice puts the ball down, glides it over, and Gabriel takes care of it from there. 1-0 to the Arsenal, and you're like, it's like obviously a roar around the Emirates, but it's also a roar of relief, if you like, because like, okay, the goal's come. Now can we see it off? And they did, because it was over 13 minutes, Arsenal scored 4 goals that put this game to bed. Martinelli got goal number 2. Gyökeres got goal number 3. Gyökeres got goal number 4. Now, Zubimendi's part in this, in terms of opening it up, is key, particularly in goal number 2. He's just the guy that sucks people in and then plays the little passes that get them out of there. I'll talk about more him in a minute. Gyökeres, goal number 3, is a little bit lucky. You know, he's in the right place and he kind of needs a moment like this where he scores with a tackle, basically, and goalkeepers just doesn't know which way it's going to go and it goes the other way.
For Michael Olise for Bayern at the weekend. Worked again for Gyökeres here.
Yeah, I mean, I blame Joe Bellingham a little bit more so for the Michael Olise one. But yeah, it's similar. And then, yeah, goal number 4, Gyökeres at the far post as Gabriel heads it back across goal from a corner. Tried and tested again from the Arsenal. Importantly, mate, 72 minutes, Zubimendi goes off, Gabriel goes off. Just wrap them in cotton wool. Wrap those 2 in cotton wool, because they are your MVPs at the moment. We said the other day on Patreon, we had a conversation. Hopefully most of you listened to it. We were breaking down what's wrong with Liverpool at the moment. And, you know, I said that Liverpool they've got too much going on at the moment. The players that they've got are coming in as like almost an embarrassment of riches, but they have the deepest squad. And then we talked a bit further and you compared it to Arsenal and you said, well, Arsenal don't really have any flaws in their squad. And I kind of said, I beg to differ a bit because I feel like you take Gabriel or Zubimendi out of that team and they're not the same. And as I watched this, I was like, this is kind of proving that point because I do feel like these two are genuinely irreplaceable. Not completely physically because they've got actual figures that could go into those positions and do fine. But the way that Gabriel not just defends, but finds his way onto 90% of set pieces. His head is just there.
Well, the fourth goal as well, right? Like it's Gabriel's header back across that sets it up.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. I mean, look, just on that point, and while we're talking about set pieces, it's worth pointing out that one, this is just not only an incredible strength, but Arsenal have taken advantage of the fact that Arteta set them up in order to, you know, dominate in the final third, to win set pieces, to get into those areas, right? And so they're getting more set pieces than most teams. They're just unbelievably effective at them. And, you know, yes, there are elements of that that people will scoff at, but that's fine. Whilst it's winning them games, it doesn't matter. And I think that just generally, you know, they have to get into those areas to win the set pieces in the first place. And look, I'm sure Atleti will have plenty of gripes around the first goal here and the Llorente thing where Martinelli caught spins into him and buys a free kick to an extent. I still think it's a free kick, right? I'm not getting against that at all. But I think that, you know, you buy that to an extent and that will frustrate them because they're probably trying to limit the amount that Arsenal can get into those areas, but actually winning them over and over again, winning the corners, winning the free kicks, etc. Yeah, it's a super strength that Gabriel gets on the end of absolutely everything, but you've still got to get into those areas. And Arsenal have made a real show and a real kind of thing of winning them on a regular basis and then getting on the end of them and making them count. That's a strength. And I think sometimes people frame it as a weakness. I really don't think it is.
It's definitely not a weakness, yeah. It's just an unbelievable thing to have in their locker. So yeah, look, 4-0 is flattering in some ways because it doesn't reflect the full game. But that 13 minutes of ruthless play is what wins you trophies and defines your season. And Arsenal just have a very good feel about them right now. 4 games in a row without conceding a goal. 6 wins in a row in all competitions. And importantly, no defeats since that Liverpool game in August when everyone was criticising them and criticising Arteta's tactics and saying same old Arsenal. Is it? I'm not so sure it is. Because this team, as I said at the start, feel like they've grown up and I'm taking them very, very seriously, not just in terms of winning the Premier League title, but maybe even getting to a Champions League final at this, right?
Yeah, I think it's totally fair. They're among the favourites of the competition for a reason, and it's because they're incredibly hard to beat, and they have multiple ways in which they can hurt you. Just a word on Victor Gyökeres, because he won man of the match, which I thought was interesting. He obviously scores 2 goals. Both of them are quite scruffy goals in terms of the way they go in. The first one's a bit of deflection. The second one is a kind of bounce over the line off his hip. He's now got 8 goals in his first 11 Champions League games. And I think maybe underrated in this performance, when people see the goals, they'll be like, oh, Gyökeres just scored 2 goals from, you know, about 4 yards out combined. But I thought his hold-up play, you know, from listening to it, the way that people were talking about him and the way that it was discussed, what he was doing, bringing others into play, probably just deserves a little bit of a highlight.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of supported him all season so far. It isn't. He's not.
I think he opens
flop.
Up chances for other players, and then that is as important as anything else right now in this Arsenal side.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is people are just expecting him to like go head to head with Haaland or something for the Golden Boot, and that was always unlikely. Like, I'm not saying that his goal record overall this season is good enough, because I do think he's got to start converting a few more, but I do think that he will end up converting more. And I think that actually just some of the chances that he gets, he's either like just too far wide of goal, or it's just like 1 yard away from like exactly where he would want to be a lot of the time with his Premier League chances. But this performance is like, he works tirelessly every single game, works so hard. His runs are really good. His positioning's really good. He's so determined to succeed in this team. And we know he's a goal scorer. And we know that he's powerful, can also create his own goal scoring chances. So I do think that Gyökeres is another step forward towards winning trophies. I really do. Now, I've been struggling with this a little bit in my own mind because I've got him in my fantasy team and in my FPL. And I'm trying to stick with it, and try and convince myself as well as others that I think he's a good pick. And right now, I'd say, look, I'm sticking with him. I don't think other people should be buying Gyökeres in their fantasy teams right now. But over the course of this season, I think that he'll be up there. I think that he'll be measuring up against the best. And when you watch this performance, you see some of those all-round traits that he's got. And maybe scoring goals of this manner was what he needed. Like, it's not a coincidence. He's still there. You've got to be in that position to score. And yeah, the first goal he gets is quite literally a tackle, and it kind of deflects in a way that Atleti can't do anything about it, and it veers into the opposite corner that he was probably trying to stick it into. But the second one is like a poacher's instinct, and that is what good goal scorers do. They're in those areas and they prod them home with any part of their body they can that isn't their arm, and he did that. So it's good for him, it's good for Arsenal, and we'll see how he grows out from here.
Yeah, 100%. But a massive win for Arsenal, who remain perfect in the Champions League so far. I want to go across to maybe the nuttiest game of the night that took place in Germany. Bayer Leverkusen 2, PSG 7.
Yeah, I mean, I've just seen very quick highlights of this one, and I didn't realise it ended up 7. I didn't know that. I thought it was like 4 or 5 from what I'd seen flashing up on my phone, because I don't like to like see all the other scores as I'm watching the other one. So I thought it was like topped out at 5. And then they showed another goal and I was 6. I was like, oh, this one must have been no. And said, oh, 7? Where does this stop?
Well, it stopped at 7 and PSG have thrown down the gauntlet a little bit. Let me quickly describe to you what happened here, because this truly was quite remarkable in some ways. An absolutely insane game. It had a little bit of everything. So William Pacho scored the opener, headed it in from across. Great ball from Nuno Mendes. It's a good header from Pacho to get things going. And then it just went a little bit mad. So like some of the PSG vanguard returned in this one. We saw in their game against Strasbourg on Friday that there was a few key players missing. And there's still a couple of key players missing. No Joao Neves at the moment, no Marquinhos at the moment. But Pacho came back, Vitini came back, Ousmane Dembele came back off the bench. We'll talk about him in a second. And Kvaratskhelia came back. And look, Leverkusen spurned a massive chance to equalise. Grimaldo missed the penalty, hit the post. He's been so reliable for this Leverkusen team. And at that moment, you kind of thought, you know, is this done? It just felt like he rushed it a little bit after a bit of a wait for a VAR check. He smacked it into the upright after kind of very short run up, which is a little bit unlike him. And PSG hit the post at the other end with Mulu coming close. And then the sort of first real flashpoint of the game takes place. Robert Andrić, who was the captain for Bayer Leverkusen, he was sent off after about half an hour for a leading elbow on Desiré Doué. And it looked at that point like it was pretty much game over. PSG won up and a man up. And you're thinking, okay, are they going to just run absolute riot here? But it flipped again a couple of times, because just a couple of minutes later, Christian Kofi ran in behind. He was pulled back by Zabani, who was already on a yellow card for the original penalty decision. And he was sent off, direct red card, for basically a last man challenge. And Alex Garcia took the ball off Grimaldo and was like, no, this one for me, I'm afraid, pal. And he tucked it away, 1-1, 10 men each. And you're like, okay, hang on. From about 30 seconds ago, I thought this game was dead. And suddenly it's 1-1 and it's all been leveled up in terms of personnel. But you know what? Mark of champions, PSG, you know, the game opens up. And look, maybe a game like this suits them, right? Because 1-on-1, they're better than pretty much every other team on the planet. And they have such brilliant individual soloists that games open up in this kind of regard. So Kvara and Doué combined, and Doué takes the ball in the box. He slots it home so calmly into the opposite corner. And PSG sort of like go for the throat at that moment, right? Because with four teenagers on the pitch, two on each side, and you're thinking, okay, this could go a bit anywhere, considering there is now 10 men on each side. And, you know, Kvara adds another one in joyful style. He gets the ball on a rebound. He gets a little bit lucky with the bounce. But then the strike hits both posts, the inside of both posts, before it finally nestles in the back of the net. And then they kill the game before half time. Kvara, again, running through the middle. He passes the ball over to Doué, who takes sort of one touch outside the area and curls a beauty into the far corner. And at this point, you're like, are they just having their own sort of goal of the game competition as to who can actually score the best goal. And you're kind of looking at that. The second half played out a little bit as you might expect. PSG kept the ball, then unleashing with this kind of ferocious pace and these one-on-one specialists. And, you know, Vitinha goes dancing through midfield and he releases an on-rushing Nuno Mendes through the middle. He strokes home the fifth. Maybe Mark Flecken should do a little bit better with this one. But I would say this, there is no other fullback in world football apart from maybe Achraf Hakimi who would be in this position. It's Nuno Mendes literally streaking through the middle of the pitch. And you're like, hang on, you're watching it go through. You're like, who is that? Who's gone on that run? And you're like, oh, it's Nuno Mendes, he's the left back. And he's just come marauding through the middle of the pitch to actually get that goal. He's so effective and he's streets ahead of anybody else in that left back conversation right now. It's funny because then Leverkusen actually score a second. And this is perhaps the best of the lot. Alex Garcia sort of picks the ball up about 25, 30 yards from goal and just unleashes a howitzer into the top corner. It is a glorious strike, perhaps the best goal of the entire night, to be perfectly honest with you. Really, really good. But it was a strange moment because the game felt so done. Nobody really cared. Like Garcia was just that player and he kind of didn't, you know, kind of shrugged his shoulders in this one. He's a hell of a player though. And look, he was excellent at Girona and now he's a part of this Leverkusen team. He's one of the midfielders that's been asked to kind of pick up the slack after Granit Xhaka's departure. He's a very, very talented footballer and I'd be still quite surprised if he doesn't make that Spain squad for the World Cup next summer. But as if it wasn't mental enough, PSG decided that this was the moment where they were going to throw on Ballon d'Or winner Ousmane Dembele. And he basically scored with almost his first touch after around an hour, you know, tapping home. And with time running out, Vitinha fires home a seventh from the edge of the box to really lay down the gauntlet for everyone else. And look, I think you can take this performance and what's going on here with PSG with a little bit of a pinch of salt. There is an element of it where you're kind of looking at it and saying, okay, 10 men against 10 men with the pitch super stretched. You know that players like Doué and Kvaratskhelia and with Vitinha running everything in midfield again, there is always going to be an element of seeing PSG and going, okay, that's a game state or that they can exploit. So, of course, you kind of have to look at the amount of goals they score here and say, okay, this isn't necessarily what we're going to see from PSG week in, week out. What I thought was remarkable about this performance was the intensity that they showed even with 10 men. And yes, okay, obviously you can bring on incredibly special players, you know, in the latter half of this one. You can bring on the likes of Ousmane Dembele, who's just gone and won the Ballon d'Or, in order to come into these moments and make it all stick together. But I think that, you know, what PSG did here in a game that they had control of and then they lost control of and everything else kind of came back together and they had to go and win it all over again. Yes, in a state that suited them, but definitely still had to go and make sure that they got the job done. Those three goals between the sort of 38th and 45th minute to make sure that the game was killed stone dead, that's a mark of champions as far as I'm concerned. And what they did in the second half, controlling it and just allowing these players the freedom of expression in a difficult period for PSG. They're not top of Ligue 1 at the moment. You know, Marseille have overtaken them after that draw with Strasbourg. To just remind everyone that they are not going anywhere from a European perspective, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I saw them kind of, the last two goals all just kind of laughing between each other. Like they, it was just seemed like a very strange
playground football by the end, right? Fair enough.
Yeah. It looked that way when by the time Vitinha and Dembele were scoring. It was just like, just one of those days. Like this is just a weird old game and we'll just take it for what it is. But obviously, as the champions, you want days like this where you show your authority and they've clearly gone and done that.
Yeah, but also Leverkusen on paper, and I know that Leverkusen are having a weird season with Kasper Hjulmand coming in and Ten Hag being sacked so early. But, you know, Leverkusen on paper is still one of the harder games away from home that PSG are going to face. And they've just dropped seven goals on them. Like, that's a mark. And it should be taken account of, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, the red card situation, like at the timing of it, still seems like it would have had significance given just the way that it changed the game. I know that it's equal for both teams when you're both getting a red card, but I just feel like Leverkusen going down to 10 is just more harmful. It's just more harmful.
You don't want to give PSG that kind of space, right? Like,
You don't want to give them time, especially when it's Andrich that goes. It's just like that's tough to take. And I know PSG fans will say, "Well, we got lost Zabanyu. Like he's our centre back," and blah blah blah. It's like, man, you can deal with that. You can deal with that.
There's enough quality on the pitch to
exactly, and you're going to be on the front. Yeah, so you have to consider that, but still, maybe seven's a bit of a stretch. It's a bit like a kid's game at that point.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Right, we'll take a little break there, and we come back afterwards. Let's talk about big wins for Barcelona and for Newcastle as well. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, working through an incredible night of action in Tuesday's Champions League games. And we're going to come on now to a big win also for Barcelona, 6-1 against Olympiacos. And again, a bit like the Arsenal one, Dean, this not as simple as perhaps it looks from the scoreline apiece.
No, I mean, Barcelona were probably going to win the game, but it's a red card to Olympiacos just before the hour mark, and an extremely controversial one that really allows Barca to go and run rampant towards the end of the game. I mean, the refs had a complete nightmare, to be honest with you. But look, Barca took control through Fermín López, who has had a very good game. There's a Clásico upcoming, and I think he's done the best he can to put his case forward for starting that one. He's bagged the hat trick, and he was the guy that scored the first two goals, and they were well taken goals as well. And then, so yeah, half time, Barca are 2-0 in front. You're like, okay, no dramas here. And then, I mean, you've kind of got to go and back and watch this 7 minutes of football for yourself. Go and watch the highlights and just watch what happens with Olympiacos, because they think they've scored. The goal then gets ruled out on VAR, and then they get a penalty. It's all very, very confusing. Barcelona, 1 minute, think, oh, we've got away with that one. And they're like, well, you haven't actually, because we're going to give a penalty. It's like, oh, okay. And then they score anyway. So it's like, okay. It was funny because at the time I was recording
this. No idea what was going on.
Mate, I had no idea because
it's loud. Bizarre.
I was recording another show at the time, the fantasy show that I do. And so I was watching the game with no sound at this point. And I was like, what is going on? The score in the top left corner just kept changing from 2-1 to 2-0. And no one seemed to know what the score even was or what the referee was doing. But after the goal was decided as the penalty, they're back in the game, 2-1. And then Santiago Heze picks up a second yellow card that it just isn't, it's just not a booking. Casado goes to ground. He hasn't touched him. And VAR can't look at it because it's a yellow card. It's a second booking. Mm-hmm. And there's no way back from it. And it's so, so harsh. That's on 57 minutes.
The referee gave loads of yellow cards in this game, I thought. And actually, he was very, very quick to book players. And look, this one, I think, is just an incorrect decision, right, in terms of how it comes about. But he was really, really hot on the yellow cards for the entire game. And I would say that was for both sides. This is just a wrong call.
Yeah, Barca actually only got one yellow card, but yeah, Olympiacos did get four, but five if you count the double. But ultimately, it was harsh, man, and I can't believe we won't be reading more about this because it's just outrageous. Anyway, Lamine Yamal then scores a penalty after VAR award on 68 minutes, and over the next 11 minutes, they go and score another three goals. Rashford grabs a brace. Fermín completes his hat trick. And the jobs are good. And Rashford at 27 was the oldest player in the starting lineup for Barcelona. That's the stage we've all got to in our football watching life. Marcus Rashford is the oldest Barca player on the pitch. One, it's bonkers he's playing for Barcelona. It still feels weird saying that. Two, it's weird to say that Rashford can be the oldest player on the pitch. His finishing was great, though. Like, the first goal is like a standstill.
Yeah.
He's just at a standstill. He's standing there. It's like five-a-side stuff. And then he just kind of whips it in. And the second goal also whips it in, but in a different way. Two lovely finishes from Rashford. And this spell in Spain really is doing him good. Like, I don't know how much his actual lifestyle's changed. I don't know any of those things about him. But what I do know is the fact that he's not in the public eye in England, where people would typically pursue him easier, where he could be out and everybody in general public knows who Marcus Rashford is, so there's no hiding and they've all got camera phone. Like, he doesn't seem to be having to deal with that as much anymore. So maybe he can just get on with his life a bit more and just enjoy the situation that he's in. There's less pressure. There's all these things are just reduced for Marcus Rashford, except for, I guess, the expectation that he's got of himself, which is to go and earn a full-time contract with Barcelona. He believes he's going to be a Barca player long-term. If he carries on doing this, he probably will be. But yeah, Barcelona 6, Olympiacos 1. Yeah, like the first game I spoke about, not quite as easy as it looks on the tin. But nevertheless, there's a quick blitz of goals that absolutely kills off an opponent and shows that, again, that's what it takes to be a contender for a trophy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's loads of positives from a Barcelona perspective. It wasn't as easy as it looked on paper, but Fermin dropping a hat-trick is really quite impressive. You know, the first Spanish player ever to score a hat-trick for Barcelona, which is a really big one in the Champions League, which I think is very cool. But also,
I like the way just to talk about Fermin, like, and the way that he even plays, like, he's just got, like, in this team, it's obviously like Barca are always superstars, and you're always talking about Lamine or Rafinha last season when he got his had his big time, and Rashford coming in, and these are the guys that are always going to get the attention. But you always need other players in those big teams that kind of just do their job quietly. And for me, the way that he can kind of he just drifts into these positions, right, and he just does it effortlessly almost. It just feels like he'll work really hard for the team. He's not looking for glory. He's not looking for everybody to applaud him. He's not looking for accolades. He'll just work really hard to make sure he's in the team. We'll go and win the ball back for you. But at the same time, he will work in tandem with those superstars to, one, make them look good, but two, to make sure their hard work isn't for nothing, because he's turning up in those spaces where you want to make sure that, yeah, they turn into goals.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Look, I think in terms of, you know, everything else, they were able to not have to bring Ferran Torres on, who you'd imagine might well start through the middle in the Clásico at the weekend. They were able to just leave him on the bench and make sure that he can have that extra recovery time. For Lamine, you know, with his work rate coming in there, and we've talked a little bit about this already on Patreon, but the fact is that Barcelona have looked a little bit ropey from a backline perspective, not just because there are a couple of players missing, that's obviously one part of it, but also because the pressure on the ball wasn't there at the weekend, you know, after the first 20 minutes or so against Girona. Well, Fermin is going to bring you that every single time, as is Ferran, right? So if you can get those two into the starting lineup against Real Madrid, you change the way that that game works from a kind of forward pressing perspective. I thought that Joe Fernandez did really well. I didn't think that Tony Fernandez was excellent against Girona, but I thought that Joe did really well here. He obviously gets his assist for Fermin's second, which is a nice moment for him in just his second start, I believe, for Barcelona. But you're seeing that Pedri went off for the last 10 minutes. So, you know, as you were saying about Zubimendi, you can wrap in him in a little bit of cotton wool. They did the same with Alex Balde, you know, bringing Gerard Martin on. He gets an assist for Rashford. But more than that, keeping Balde safe and protected when we know that he's working his way back from injury as well. And Lamine Yamal goes off, you know, with 10, 15 minutes to play as well. And that for me is the kind of way that Barcelona were able to kind of turn this in their favor. Yes, the red card helps them, obviously. And I feel for Santiago Heza, who's a really, really good player and someone I really like. And I can see him having a move to one of the bigger clubs in Europe at some point in his career. But the way that Barcelona stepped on, you know, Olympiacos' throat here, and after they'd battled hard, but, you know, had been unlucky in terms of the decision, you've got to take those opportunities when they're given to you. And Barcelona did that with aplomb in a way that we haven't seen other teams do it at times as well. So I think huge positives from them in that perspective. I wanted to come over on now to Newcastle, who won 3-0 against Benfica. And again, the scoreline probably tells a slightly different story. Now, Newcastle were the better side and deserved to win this game over the course of 90 minutes, but it wasn't one of those games where there was complete dominance. And, you know, it was an absolutely corking game in many ways, and I really, really enjoyed it. It was far less cagey than I was expecting, given the changes in the lineup from a Newcastle perspective, and of course, a Jose Mourinho Benfica side. They traded blows early. Dodi Lukebakio was torching Dan Burn down the Newcastle left. He played at left back in this game, hit the post with a great effort. Luca Bacchio forced Pope into two excellent saves as well in the first half. And I thought what Benfica did really well was they tried to play down the left and they isolated Burn against Luca Bacchio on that right-hand side. And he took advantage of it, really creating a load of different elements. But Newcastle were doing something similar and they were creating as well. And after Trubin denied Bruno Guimarães, the Brazilian carved out the opener. He played in Jacob Murphy with an exquisite ball through the defence to just pick out the right winger, who had a really, really good game, I thought. And, you know, Jacob Murphy squares it for Anthony Gordon, who couldn't miss from 6 yards out. And the two continued to play trade blows. And what I thought was interesting about this from a Newcastle perspective was I really like Lewis Miley, but Sandro Tonali missing felt like a really big one. They struggled to control the midfield and Benfica took full advantage of that, I thought, in the first half. I thought that Enzo Barinichea, who was originally on loan from Aston Villa, but I believe already that's been made permanent because he's made 15 appearances already this season for Benfica. I thought he was absolutely excellent in the middle of the park. And Murphy was really good going the other way, right? He stepped in here again. He picked up where he left off last season. The first half was really even, but again, you know, Newcastle come in with this 1-0 lead. And I think that there would have been an element of frustration and also nerves around St. James's Park with the way that the game had opened up and the way that Benfica were creating chances. And I felt like Newcastle lacked a little bit of aggression in terms of how things were working. And look, obviously, Tonali's, you know, had an illness. You can't play in an Eddie Howe side if you're not 100% because of the demands that he makes on you. But I thought the Newcastle started the second half in a far more aggressive manner. They should have scored a second earlier than they actually did. Volta Marda had a shot well saved. Lewis Miley headed over from point blank range after a corner. And then Trubin tipped a Murphy effort wide. But they score this brilliant, brilliant second goal. And Dean, you will absolutely love the way that this came about. Nick Pope picking the ball up from a corner and launches a throw. And I mean launches. He like takes a run up. The ball's like by his feet with his arm down there. And he just basically like chucks it as far as he can. It bounces. And it caught the defence of Benfica napping a little bit. Substitute Harvey Barnes races through to fire off the far post and in. It was really, really good quick thinking from Pope. And then Barnes did brilliantly to hold off Antonio Silva and kind of make sure that shot went across the keeper. And Trubin had a really good game at this point and into the back of the net. But there will be a lot made of this. And Nick Pope's distribution is sometimes unfairly criticised. And fairly rather than unfairly, I probably should add. But I think that there are legitimate concerns you can have with that. This is unbelievable in terms of launching a throw, but also knowing exactly what Barnes is going to do and then kind of picking him out with this pass. It really is quite special. And Newcastle's third was an absolute thing of beauty as well. Gorgeous interplay from Gordon Volta Marda. Gordon slips in Barnes to score again, but it is brilliant, absolutely sensational from the big German. Cushions this fired Gordon pass back into him, past the defender with this like perfect Maradona-esque flick, you know, through his own legs and cushioned perfectly into the path of Anthony Gordon, who slides it in for Harvey Barnes to slot home. And a big night at St. James's Park. Like, they hadn't won in the Champions League. And obviously, you know, circumstances dictate this. They weren't in the competition last year. But since that night against PSG, you know, 2 seasons ago, which ultimately didn't end up with them qualifying into those knockout stages. And I think there was a bit of pressure coming into this game for them to carry on against a Jose Mourinho side who'd been bigging up Newcastle, bigging up St. James's Park, talking about the effect that this crowd can have. And yet, you know, they were able to hang on at times from, you know, some interesting Benfica attacks that really did kind of challenge them to make things happen. And then they find these goals in different ways. The three goals come from very different scenarios. But Newcastle are starting to find their groove and they're starting to find out exactly how this team works. And another very, very big performance from Nick Volta Marda. Very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why you've got such a big smile on your face, mate. They're playing Fulham at the weekend.
Oh, I know, but I'm taking some hope from the fact that, you know, obviously Brighton did a job on them in the Premier League, but it does feel like this style is quite suited to actually Champions League games, especially when they open up like this.
Yeah, maybe. We'll wait to see. I hope you're right, but yeah, it's a bit worrying to me, you know, Gordon and Barnes being the two that that are on the score sheet for this one. He's obviously trying very carefully to balance the minutes. Jacob Murphy is such an important player and just has this absolute art of being able to put chances on a plate for people. Volta Marder's come into the team. Look, I keep saying, I haven't seen this game obviously yet, but he hasn't been perfect so far. But in terms of fitting in and working hard and trying to make it work, he's been great. And like the fact
he makes other players around him better as well as being important himself. And I think that's a really, really good trait.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we're waiting to see if it's a floor of the team is obviously the fullbacks, Dan Byrne and Kieran Trippier. They've got Lewis Hall and Livramento out at the moment and for a while. So, you know, if you're an opposing team, you're hoping that those areas prove to be vulnerabilities. But I don't know. Maybe it's not always.
No, I mean, look, Dan Byrne did look like a vulnerability in the first half in particular, I think. And you know, if you get him isolated, then, you know, players like Luka Bakio, who's an incredible player in his own right, right? And was at Sevilla last year and one of the very few bright sparks in that team, ended up going to Benfica and has kind of nailed down that spot on the right-hand side for himself now. I think that the centre-backs remain quite strong from a Newcastle perspective. Vangelis Pavlidis didn't have much of a sniff in this game, and he is a very, very good player and has proved that time and time again in the Champions League. So I think there's, you know, things that you can look at, and there are positives and negatives to this performance, but people will be leaving St. James's Park very, very happy tonight. And, you know, after Mourinho said this is not a crowd that comes to support their team, this is a crowd that comes to kick every ball and play every minute alongside their team, I thought they showed up in great voice tonight as well. And obviously at the home of his old mentor, Sir Bobby Robson, Mourinho handed a little bit of a lesson in the Champions League as well by a very, very good Newcastle side, especially in the second half when they took control of this one. I thought they were very impressive.
Yeah, very good. Well done, Eddie Howe.
Yes, well done, Eddie Howe, indeed. Right, we'll take another break there when we come back. Going to wrap up everything else that happened in the Champions League as well. Stick with us here on Ranks FC.
Welcome back to Ranks FC. Strap yourselves in. Jack, you take a deep breath because you have a lot of explaining to do about what happened in all the other Champions League games that I haven't seen.
Yes. Five other games to get through here. And look, a lot of excitement, a lot of goals as well to talk about. So I think it's probably best to start in Eindhoven. PSV 6, Napoli 2. I'll walk you through the game and then I'll give you some general thoughts about Napoli in particular. But it was, you know, the first half of this was a really good battle. PSV missed a big chance early on when Goose Till headed straight at the keeper, and Napoli took advantage of that. Scott McTominay returning to the team after missing the loss to Torino at the weekend, returning with a bullet header to kind of show the Dutchman how it was done. Really, really great cross from Spinazzola as well, but a fantastic header from Scott McTominay coming back. PSV hit back and Perisic was like, anything you can do, I can do better. Gorgeous cross from him into this attack by Till, but it actually hit Buongiorno and looped into the Napoli net. And then Napoli just seemingly forgot how to defend. They threw everyone forward as if it was like the 93rd minute and they were chasing a game. And they got caught on the break with absolutely zero defenders back. It was one of the most bizarre things I've seen in ages. In like the 40s.
Sounds like my under 10 team.
It was really strange because, look, Goose Till gets the ball in his own box and he's like almost looking at it confused. He feeds Saibari and Saibari's inside his own half and just runs clear on goal, lifts it over the goalkeeper. Conte will be absolutely fuming with his defensive line for what happened here. And Napoli then came out firing in the second half and they get stung by this brilliant PSV move about 10 minutes into the second half. They work it down the right and Napoli are sort of scrambling defensively. And I've got questions about this kind of generally, but Mauro Junior, who's playing at right back, danced down the edge of the box, pulled it back for Dennis Mann and he touched it through the defender's legs into the far corner. Dennis Mann deserved this. I thought he was absolutely excellent for PSV throughout. And he's starting to kind of really make an impact on this team. Really, really good player and was excellent at Parma. I'm glad he's kind of got a move that's continuing to showcase his brilliance in many ways. PSV then hit the post through Jordi Skouten as they push for this fourth. And Napoli are all over the place from a defensive perspective at this point. And look, these are the notes that I wrote. I'm going to read you out them in the order that I wrote them.
Okay. Rank your notes.
Yeah, Lorenzo Luca is deputizing for Hoyland and, of course, Lukaku at the moment. And he just doesn't look up to it. And I wrote this. And I thought selling Raspadori and maybe Gio Simeone, who scored against them at the weekend in the summer, looks like it might have been a bit of a mistake in hindsight. And he then got sent off. I wrote that before he decided to get sent off for what appears like dissent, because there's no challenge. And basically he gets not taken down the box, perfectly fair tackle. And he looks at the referee and he starts making crazy loop noises or signals with his hand. And I think the referee has sent him off for saying the referee is mental. And I think that's the kind of movement that you're looking at, because he starts going with the kind of swirly finger around his temple. Yeah. I'm like, crazy, but there's no other reason to send him off in this situation. It hasn't been revealed yet exactly what it's been done for, but we'll see that obviously in the post-match. And PSV then rubs salt in these Neapolitan wounds with a fourth. Dennis Mann again, this time with a wonder strike. He cuts in off that right-hand side and rifles one into the near corner. And at that point, it was 4-1, and I wrote, PSV's first win of the competition this season. At that moment, it all goes a bit nuts again. Napoli scores consolation when Scott McTominay heads one in from a corner. But like within a minute of the restart, PSV went back down the other end and restored the advantage. It was Ricardo Pepi, just back from that major injury, tapping home after Druech was released down the left. And he's released past Di Lorenzo, and I hate seeing this because I love Di Lorenzo, but he looked like he was running in treacle, right? As this ball is played through. And yes, he's had to work really hard in this game. PSV were very good down the wings, and he's just got a new player off the bench running up against him. And they've got 10 men at this point, which I totally accept. He kind of squares it across Driech and then Pepi taps it home. And apparently PSV didn't enjoy being provoked by that second Scott McTominay goal because they added a sixth for a good measure. This time the roles reversed. Pepi touches the ball into Driech's path and he fires another one home. A rocket past Milinkovic-Savic in net. Not that one, his brother. But in terms of, look, PSV picking up their first win of the competition, this was a side who were soundly beaten by Union Saint-Gilloise in the first game of this Champions League campaign at home. And you were thinking, oh God, this doesn't look good from a PSV perspective. And we said at the time, right, Petr Bosch has this thing where he sets his sides up to attack and sometimes they can be picked off by teams who are playing really well on the counter. But it just didn't happen today. And PSV are starting to click from an offensive perspective. It looks quite good from where they're standing at the moment, especially with Ajax struggling. And Napoli having a real bad time of it. Obviously, they lose to Torino at the weekend. They look defensively suspect in that one. They look very defensively suspect here. Even when they had 11 men, it didn't look great from a Napoli perspective. And I think the fact that they were scrambling speaks to a lot about where this team is at right now. Yes, they have injuries. Yes, there are key players out, and I totally accept that. But you would expect the Conte side to have that kind of well-drilled element about them, and they just don't look anywhere near as balanced as they did last season. It's starting to become a little bit of a concern.
Yeah, I mean, it's another game. It seems there's been a lot of games that have been influenced late on by these red cards over this game week, and, you know, without seeing it, I'm sure that it's had some effect, but clearly PSV were taking hold of the game by that point. But Napoli have got Inter Milan
at that point, right? Yeah. And Inter Milan at the Maradona at the weekend, and that is not going to be pretty.
That's what's weird, yeah. I mean, so yeah, it's 3-1 in the moment when the red card comes, which is 76 minutes. And then there's another 3-1 scoreline that comes after that point, which ends up making the overall score 6-2. So in any shape or form, like, that's a crumble. From a Napoli perspective, like, you would expect that you could at least close up a bit. I mean, you've seen whether they went bombing on, did they leave it too open?
They didn't, but that maybe at the start of the second half when PSV scored their third, Napoli have kind of committed a few too many players forward. But actually, the worrying thing is the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, maybe the fifth, in terms of they've just scored and they're like trying to push forward to see if they can kind of, you know, make it a very, not entertaining, but can I put any pressure on before those final minutes? But, you know, to concede a minute after scoring a goal that maybe gives you even a slight lifeline, and then just some of the haphazardness of the way that they were going about their business from a defensive perspective, really quite awkward, I think, and not what you expect at all from Conte's side.
Yeah, exactly that. So I'm sure they'll just be like, look, let's bury this one. Let's pretend this one didn't happen and let's reset ready for the weekend, because this next one is a big, big one.
Well, Hoyland was on the bench, but they decided that they wasn't going to use him. So perhaps he'll be back for the weekend, and by God, they could do with it, because Luka doesn't look up to it at all. And also the way that they play with him, you know, he's obviously a gigantic human being, 6'7", but you know, you can use that late in games. You can use that as a battering ram, but it completely changes the way they try to play. You know, we've spoken so much already about Napoli this season and Kevin De Bruyne is sliding through those balls for Rasmus Højlund, and the way that he's kind of going about his business, stretching defenses. Well, that's a lot of what Lukaku does, right? And actually with Luka in there, it looks very, very different and quite uncomfortable, I think, from Napoli's kind of attacking point of view. And it does need to be fixed, because this could become a little bit of a slide if they're not careful. Talking of Inter, who go to Napoli at the weekend, they went to Belgium to play Union Saint-Gilloise and they won 4-0. Now, USG started this game really excellently. Promise David had a couple of early opportunities. Jan Sommer having to make a couple of saves. He looks back to his best after a couple of shaky performances earlier on in the season. But Inter really did have him to thank. They had to weather a huge storm from the hosts in the first 20 minutes or so of this one. But Inter grew into it and they scored from a set piece. Bissek knocked down a corner to Dumfries, who scored his second Champions League goal in two games, still masquerading as a number nine after all these years. Enjoyable to see that he is not going to change for anyone. And then look, USG started to push even harder. They were killed on the stroke of halftime with a perfect counterattack. Dumfries runs in behind. He shrugs off a defender and he squares it for Pio Esposito, who feeds Lautaro. And I like this because the ball goes across to him. He could shoot, but he sees his captain arriving. And for a young player, you know, he kind of just squares it and Lautaro fires it into the far corner. And at that point, you're like, okay, probably game done, because Inter are quite comfortable sitting in deep. And whilst that first 20 minutes was a little bit kind of a storm they had to weather, as I say, it did feel like the game was then in their hands and they were able to sort of launch these counterattacks. And they made it safe pretty quickly after the break. Silly penalty given away from Kevin McAllister for a raised hand that hit Lautaro's header. And obviously Hakan Çalhanoğlu didn't miss the penalty. He never misses penalties. 3-0 and job done. It was funny then, because Johan Angeboni comes on for Lautaro. And this has been one of the things that I've kind of been interested in throughout. It's how the Inter kind of second choice strikers, if you will, if we assume that Lautaro and Thuram are going to be the kind of first two, which is fine. And obviously two unbelievable players. You know, last season, they didn't have those backup scoring goals. Pio Esposito and Angio Amboni brought in, or brought back and brought in terms of the summer. And they've been really good in terms of rotating them, but also utilizing their different skill sets. And Pio Esposito misses an absolute sitter to make this 4-0. He somehow screws the ball wide after it's pulled back to him with the goal gaping. Not one he's going to want to see again. But the best trait in a striker is to forget it and finish the next one. And that's exactly what he did. Bonny came on for Lautaro and he sets up Esposito to slide in a fourth and make it a lot easier to swallow the first miss. I love watching Pio Esposito. He's having a brilliant breakout campaign after he excelled last season on loan in Serie B with Spezia. He's a real talent. And I think that what Kivu is doing really, really well, I've said this on Patreon before, but what he's doing really, really well is rotating these strikers and allowing them to play in their actual skill sets. He's finding combinations. Lautaro and Pio Esposito work really well together, but also they're quite similar in terms of their profiles. That's starting to click in a way that I don't think it did last season. And it is a really important bit for Inter. They get a really big win here after a difficult first 20, but very, very impressive. And they've just started going about their business on a more regular and more quiet basis. They're starting to keep clean sheets again. They look defensively solid again. Jan Sommer's back making big saves and they can trust him again from a defensive perspective. And the goals are coming at the other end from the players they want them to be coming from. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, complete opposite to what you were just talking about for Napoli. So there's that to consider. Very interesting, this big win.
Yeah, a very, very big win. We'll go to Spain quickly. Manchester City won 2-0 at El Madrigal against Villarreal. And to be honest, this was about as routine as it gets from a City perspective. They controlled this from the get-go and they put Villarreal under the cosh from the very beginning. And to be honest, Villarreal looked a little bit scared of Manchester City in terms of the way that they went about their game plan, especially in the first half. Then, of course, Erling Haaland scored the opener. Beautiful sweeping finish after working across his centre-back. But it was a great run and a good assist from Rico Lewis as well. I thought him playing in midfield for the first time in a while was very interesting. And I thought he was very good. And a lot of the creation came down City's right-hand side in the first half. The second goal comes from there as well. Bernardo popping up unmarked to head home, clearly having listened to what Pep said about it can't just be Erling Haaland that scores goals for Manchester City. But the captain stepped up and went, "You're right, I'll get one here." He gets unmarked from a header. I don't know what the defence are doing at that point. But a good cross from Savinho as well. And that Savinho and Rico Lewis and Mateus trident down City's right combined really well. And I thought they rotated positions nicely as well. So something to keep an eye on, I think, from a City perspective, the way that, that Rico Lewis played in midfield but was able to kind of rotate with Mateus at times. And that opened up a lot of space for Savinho to attack. I mean, City were in complete cruise control at halftime and they clearly learned from the lessons at Monaco after dropping points there. And Villarreal couldn't really find any sort of foothold in the second half. City dominated the ball, kept it very clean. A little bit of a shame for Nico Gonzalez. He went off with an injury. He might be okay long term because he was sitting on the bench rather than going down the tunnel, although he did have some ice on his leg. But he's been in really good form in the last couple of games. And I think that's gone a little bit under the radar. Villarreal created a little bit more with about 20 minutes left. Pap Gay forced a save. Pepe fired narrowly wide, but no real avail. I didn't feel like City were really under the pump at any given point. And Haaland could and probably should have had a second on the night. But some good goalkeeping from Luis Junior. I thought that Savinho was absolutely electric. First on the right and then on the left after Oscar Bob came on, switched sides. And I thought he was really impressive on both, made things happen. And he feels like he's growing into it a little bit this season at City as well. And Doku is a menace, but equally he blows hot and cold. I think that if Savinho can find some consistent form, it'd be a good thing from a City perspective, but relatively routine.
Yeah, you've just been waiting for Savinho to show that he gets it. Does he get what it is to play for Man City? And I know they play differently this season to they have any time really under Pep, but it does seem like this season it's clicking. I was surprised when they gave him a new contract and when they refused to sell him to Tottenham, I was like, really? I think I'd take 70-odd million for Savinho right now. But they decided it was absolutely not something they wanted to do. They decided to tie him down to a new contract. And with all that in mind, you've got to assume that Savinho is going to be a big part of the next gen of Man City that comes through. He got man of the match, didn't he? So that seems like...
Yeah, and rightly so as well.
Yeah, so it feels like, yeah, he's starting to show that he understands what it takes to cut it in this team.
Yep, 100%. Like, very good from City, but also very comfortable throughout. And whilst there was a little bit of late Villarreal pressure, it feels like the game really got away from them in the first half and City were just able to sit on it and control it in the second in a way that they didn't really need to push for more. There was a bit of a nutty game as well at Parken. Copenhagen 2, Dortmund 4. Felix Nmecha with the opener. A brilliant strike from him after a Joe Bellingham assist. I thought we'd come back to him at some point over the course of this show. Absolutely rifles it into the roof of the net. But Dortmund didn't really press home their advantage in the first half. And they were stung by a sort of blast from the past in some ways because, you know, they'd quietened Parken early and we know how cool and how loud that stadium can get, but it started to get going as they didn't really kind of force it home. And when the ball fell to former BVB Wunderkind, Yusuf Moukoko from a set piece, he rifled one at goal. It was blocked. But in the chaos in the six-yard box, Valdemar Anton somehow screwed the ball into his own net whilst lying prone on the floor. It's very, very odd. One of the weirder goals you'll see in the Champions League season as a whole, I thought. But actually, Copenhagen were relatively good value, I thought, for the equaliser. They were a little bit lost at sea first 20 minutes, but they grew into it. And I thought that Achiuri on their left-hand side looked really lively. He had a great battle with Jan Kauto, who was playing at right wing back for this Borussia Dortmund side. Second half was a bit cagier. Dortmund had a lot of the ball, but Copenhagen felt a bit more settled from a defensive perspective. But they shot themselves in the foot multiple times. So first, they gave away a penalty for shirt pulling on Girassi at a corner. Completely the correct decision. And Ben Sabaini made no mistake from the spot. Very cool, very calm, very collected, very Jorginho in his penalty approach. The kind of hop, skip and jump and slotting it down the middle. And I thought it was interesting. No fighting this time over the spot kick. You remember when we talked about Borussia Dortmund a couple of weeks ago, It was Ben Sabaini and Girassi having a bit of a ding-dong over who was going to take the spot kick. Ben Sabaini got that one. He scored it. He's obviously now kind of designated penalty taker because there was no complaints, and he put it away very, very comfortably. And then Nemecha made sure with about 15 minutes to play, Copenhagen just basically giving the ball away on the edge of their own box. Clem just sort of trying to play this lofted pass out to the wing. It just gets chested down, and basically Nemecha picks it up, the second ball, and wrong-foots the keeper. Weird strike. It looked like it got a deflection, but actually it didn't. Copenhagen did get a late consolation after Fabio Silva had put the icing on the Dortmund cake. He fired a volley after a bit of pinball in the area after coming on. But the Copenhagen consolation goal was maybe more interesting. It came from a youngster, 17-year-old Victor Davison from Iceland, with a really good header, actually. It's clawed away by Kerber, but it's already gone over the line. And he only made his Copenhagen debut last Friday. Today, he became the third youngest goal scorer in Champions League history. So a good couple of days for the youngster. And nice to see another one breaking through at Copenhagen. Bear in mind, if Yusuf Moukoko is the older or statesman of these two players, they've really got some fun youth bits and bobs going on in that regard. So Davison, one to keep an eye on, a name perhaps for you to keep track of over the next couple of years. But I wanted to talk about Bellingham quickly. Because Joe Bellingham still looks a bit off it from a technical perspective. He still looks a little bit clumsy with the ball, but he is barreling around and making things happen. And after, obviously, the frustration with what happened at the weekend in the Clásica, I thought that this was a good performance for him. And the fact that he was able to get around that midfield, he used his physicality really well. I thought this was much more impressive from him. And look, it's going to take time for him to settle in. And there's obviously a little bit of kind of chat going around at the moment. Sunderland fans be like, we got 30 million for this guy. A bit of those comparisons with his brother, which are never particularly helpful. And one of the reasons I wasn't sure that Dortmund was the right fit for Joe Bellingham. This was a better performance. And I think he probably deserves some credit for the way he went about his business here. Dortmund have now scored 12 goals in three Champions League games, Dave. They've scored four in every single game. They look very sharp offensively at the very least.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been a bit of nonsense around Joe Bellingham, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, there was reports, oh, he's already like having fallouts. He's ready to look for a club in January. Oh, Man United are looking at Joe Bellingham. No, they're not. No, he's not. Everything's fine. Like, Joe Bellingham is at a better club than any of the others that were potentially interested in signing him from Sunderland before. No one of this level was going to give Joe Bellingham a chance, especially in England. Like, the opportunities just weren't there.
Eintracht, I think, would have been an interesting fit for him and a different German club where the spotlight was maybe a little bit less bright on the comparisons. That's the only place I would have really looked in terms of what was going on. But look, we know what the track record is at Borussia Dortmund. And ultimately, if someone he feels comfortable and feels like he can grow, then that's his kind of decision to make.
Yeah,
and
look,
he has to deal with that comparison.
Like, I don't mean this sounds right. He's not that good, right? He's not that good that he should be playing every single week starting role for Borussia Dortmund. But he started two of their three Champions League games so far. He got 20-odd minutes the other day against Bayern Munich, ended up costing them a goal. Like, he's still got so much to learn and growth. Like, he's about where he could possibly be right now, as far as I'm concerned. Like, he's making the most of his talent. And, like, he chose to follow this path through Dortmund. That's up to him. But he's not going to get the equivalent of Dortmund over in England right now. And I don't think anywhere else right now. And I, from what I understand, Dortmund are completely supportive of him. They feel like he could be doing a bit better, but equally, they're not looking to offload him in January. So I keep reading this and I'm like, this isn't going to happen. Like, where he is fine for who he is right now. It's just because he's got Bellingham as a last. There's a reason he's got Job on the back of his shirt and not Bellingham, right? And it's because he wants to kill the comparisons a bit. And like you say, it's pretty hard when your brother's been there and kind of made his name there. But let's see how he goes. I'm pleased to see that he's got through another Champions League game and had a positive impact on the game rather than a negative one.
Yeah, and he got an assist. So, you know, it's not all bad from that perspective. I also think in terms of the Clásica, like, yes, okay, he makes a mistake and he kind of slips over a little bit. I actually was quite impressed with his desire to get back there, to track back and actually be in that position to try and make
the ball. He was just a bit flat-footed, wasn't he? It was like he couldn't move fast enough. He like couldn't get his body to get the ball out before Elise. I mean, Elise does like a 15-yard slide. So it's like, like the way that he comes in is pretty admirable itself.
Yeah, I think he's a bit unlucky in that perspective, but much better tonight, and a positive for everyone to take out of that one, which leaves us with one game, Dean, which was Cairo Almaty 0, Paphos 0.
The big advert for the Champions League, yeah.
I mean, look, I was actually quite excited about this one because I was intrigued to see what was
going to happen. Of course you were. Of course you were.
I wanted to kind of see, and actually, these are the games where an underdog gets a big win and suddenly they're putting themselves in a different position, right? But the game was sort of ruined early on when Paphos had Joao Correa sent off after just 4 minutes. It was still quite entertaining as a contest, I thought. And Paphos, despite having 10 men, had the better of the chances in general. They had a goal disallowed, but I think they'll be gutted that they couldn't take advantage here because, you know, David Luiz is denied twice. One's a really good save. One he definitely should have done better with. The Paphos captain goes running through in the first half and just blasts the ball at the keeper instead of basically placing it, and probably should have scored. Kara hit the post as well. A mazy dribble from Arad saw him curl one into the woodwork, but that was as close as they came. Paphos have 2 points. Both of them have been 0-0 draws, and both of them they've had a man sent off against gettable, in inverted commas, opposition. They might come to regret that, I think, just in terms of, you know, the way that they've gone about their business. They've defended really well in the games against Olympiacos and then here against Kairat. And again, yeah, pinch of salt. But I think that they have actually been a little bit unlucky. Not that the red cards haven't been red cards, but they've let game states get away from them. And I think with 11 men, they probably win this game. So Paphos, you know, actually considering where they are and considering what they've kind of faced already, this was their big opportunity to potentially put themselves into the conversation at very least, you know, to be in that playoff spots or the bottom of them come the end of the campaign. I think that might be done now. And I think they'll come to regret what happened here over in Kairat. So yeah, a little bit of a difficult one, but actually for a 0-0, genuinely quite an entertaining game, I thought.
Well, good, mate. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I don't think I'll be watching back the highlights of that one, but it just stood out a mile on the fixture list today, didn't it? I almost didn't help. Like, you're going through all the leagues and you were like, what? It was almost like a glitch in the app.
Like, you know, like sometimes they put a Conference League game on with the Champions League games to like schedule things. It did look a little bit
like
that.
It was just like a hard sell, a very hard sell. If you were a salesman for the Champions League trying to get viewing figures up, it was like, obviously they've tried to put it on earlier, but the problem is it clash of Barcelona. Like, well, no one's going to be watching this one, mate.
Indeed. It was a tricky one to sell. I totally get that. And in the early kickoff as well, when most people are just finishing work, at least here in the UK, it's a little bit of a difficult one to get. But you know what? An entertaining one, and both those sides have earned their place in the Champions League. And thus, I thought it was one to keep an eye on and be able to tell you about. Although I agree, I probably wouldn't rush to watch the highlights if you're looking across the board with all of the other things that went on today. And with that, it's probably time for us to call it a day here on Champions League Takeaway. We'll be back tomorrow talking about the 9 games that take place on Wednesday in the Champions League. But all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. And we hope we'll see you tomorrow, Rank Squad, where we'll be looking at some other very entertaining games across the course of the Champions League. We'll see you very soon. Take it easy. Peace.